Hi, I'm Sarah Lightman, and this is Ladies Do Podcasts. This episode is the companion recording to our podcast of Trina Robbins' talk at Ladies Do Comics. And in this episode, you will hear the Q&A session she did with members of the audience.
I was thinking that the illustration that you showed of Miss Fury on the plane, and that, Tabby Mills. Yes. That was actually, it's almost exactly the one that the illustration that was adopted as the logo for Girl Comic newspaper by that was published by Halton Press here, which is really interesting. It's absolutely the same thing, and it must have been. I've now realised that the newspaper, the comic, which was published first published in the 50s. Must have been based on that iconic.
Oh well, the strip ran through 1950 and then ended. Yeah. So if that was published in the 50s, that means that they were familiar with the strip.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. Yeah. I'd love to see
that.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah. That's
Well, I think we're going to pick up where we left off because Matt.
I think we can turn this off now.
Yeah, we should give it a rest. But Matt, you were asking about the underground, and this is where.
Yes, I just want to grab a hat. My sweater.
We took a break from this cleaning booth to actually in a very awkward one. I don't know how many. Presumably, some of you will be aware that the underground comic scene in America was pretty much. It wasn't unique in the world. I'm trying to get perspective on this because there were underground scenes happening. In France, for example, in Japanese comics in the 60s, there was also... What we mean by underground, of course, is essentially is not fitting into the conventional mainstream channels, which boiled down to, in America at this time, basically two. If you want to make comics, you either do family-friendly stuff in the newspapers, or you do the newsstand, which were all, almost all anyway, comics code approved. In other words, they had a little stamp in the corner, and they had to go through an incredibly restrictive code of content, which ruled out really pretty much any adult or any other content, any serious issues, anything vaguely X-rated or controversial. It was incredibly restrictive. It was about the most restrictive code of content applied to any medium in America. And it actually completely hampered American comics for a long time, from 55, it was first probably in effect. And of course, an underground generation grew up on. They've grown up during the baby boom period, they've grown up with other comics, but also saw this action of the form, rebelled in the late, during the course of the 60s in various ways, alternative newspapers, there's one channel, the whole dope culture, underground scene, particularly on the West Coast in San Francisco. And Trina, and as you mentioned, Shelby here, we don't want to bring Shelby to this, were instrumental in turning around the comics, potential comics, which have been really suppressed in America, and as a result, their influence was enormous. You cannot underestimate how important it was. I mean, it's one of the most important art movements, as important as, if we look back, if we ever get any perspective in this, in our culture, as important as Impressionism or any other of these great incidents, because it had such an amazing flowering of talent, such diverse talent, and its impact internationally was enormous. You wouldn't have the incredible quality of comics in France, or, for example, in Japan, without the example of many of the underground artists. But to hand you over, to hand you back to where we were, as Matt was saying, what was it like, you mentioned the birth of women's comics, and why you and Shelby and your friends had to take that stance of saying, we're going to have to do our own thing, because we're not being allowed into the male-dominated...
Well, you're answering your own question. I mean, okay, I'm going to start in 1970. In 1970, there were only two women drawing comics in San Francisco. That was me and a woman named Willie Mendez. And what was happening in the underground scene, you know, the brand new, very exciting underground scene was a guy would decide he wanted to put together a comic. And he would call other cartoonists and say, I'm putting together a comic, I could use 4 pages for you, I could use 8 pages, why don't you contribute, how many pages can you do, whatever. But the cartoonists that they would ask into their books were all guys. They never, never asked me or Willie into their books. So just because I was desperate to be needed, really, I was drawing comics for underground newspapers because the newspapers were not like that. It was only the underground comics scene itself. And then this was 1970, yeah. I found out about It Ain't Me, Babe, which was the first underground women's liberation newspaper. I've since learned the first one in the country. I thought at the time that it was the first one in California. I've since learned it was actually the first one in the country. Robin Morgan told me this, so I figured Robin Morgan's going to know, you know. And I drew comics for them. And because I was working with these women who were my moral support, really, because I could not have done this alone, but these women, I had them, you know, with me. I could do it. I turned out, produced the first all-woman comic book. The very first all-woman comic book in the world. I don't know about the universe, but the first all-woman comic book. Now, I say this because it kind of pisses me off every now and then, and Sarah Lightman did it, didn't you, Sarah, wherever you are? They say, I mean, she said, why do you regard it as? You know, they're always hedging their bets. You know, someone else wrote it and said, one of the first. Well, it wasn't one of the first, and it wasn't widely regarded as the first. It was the first all-woman comic book ever published. And that was called It Ain't Me, Babe Comics, because I did it with the backing of the staff of It Ain't Me, Babe. Okay, so we got it, then we have to kind of shoot forward 2 years, because I did that comic in 1970, and because I just wanted to show those guys, you know, I wanted to produce the best comic that had ever been produced. And of course, you know, first of all, some of the women, I mean, I actually had to seek out these women and find them and say, draw a comic, you know. And it was pretty damn good, especially when you think of what it was and when it was done. It was really remarkable. I mean, I can look back now and say, my God, that's amazing. But at the time, it wasn't like better than anything that had ever been done, so I wasn't happy with it. And that's why I didn't do further issues. But the publisher, Ron Turner of Last Gasp Comics, wanted to do more all-women comics. I have to say, it wasn't the publishers that wouldn't publish me. I had no problem getting published when I did my own comic, when Willow did her own comic. The publishers were ready to publish us. It was only the guys. Only the guys. So,
it was the whole clubhouse.
Yeah, it was the clubhouse. It was the clubhouse. So Ron wanted to do more all-women comics because that one had sold really well. He knew that there was a real interest. So 2 years later, finally, what's her name?
Patty Moodian, thank you.
Patty Moodian, who worked for Ron and knew that Ron wanted to do an all-woman comic. So she got together 8 women, of which Shelby was one, I was another. 6 other women. We met, well, 5 other women, because we met at Patty Moodian's, she met 8. And we started discussing doing an all-woman comic.
And one of the things I want to insert here that really struck me is that Patty's boyfriend, Larry Todd, was one of the guys that drew comics. My boyfriend, Michael J., was one of the guys that drew comics. Most of us were wives and girlfriends of men in the first or second wave of the guy underground comics books. And most of us, not all of us, but most of us were trained artists as well. So there wasn't any real reason they could tell us that we couldn't draw comics. We could. But it was striking. Michelle Brand was married to Roger Brand. And
I
later
was not,
Aileen Kaminsky got
I was
together
neither married to nor with him.
No, you were not. You came into this from a different streak, and you've also come through and kept your interest in comics and done other things with it, where a lot of people like me, I was there for that decade of the 70s and dropped out. So Trina is definitely an exception in some, you know, a continuity that's yay for Trina.
So anyway, we met, you know, and we kept meeting and, you know, talking about what we wanted to do. And it was funny because, you know, we were trying to figure out a name for the book. And we kept saying, what shall we call this women's comic? What do we call this women's comic? And finally realized that that was its name, Women's Comics. Women's Comics lasted.
But it wasn't spelled as usual.
No, of course not. Well, we were cartoonists.
And
actually, we heard which can be heard from a lot of very hardcore feminists who said that we were spelling it wrong because the word men was in it. We were supposed to remove the word men.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
W-I-M-M-I.
Yeah. Well, the last issue did that. The very last issue finally removed the men from it. It became women's comments, yes. It lasted from 1972 to 1992, which is damn good. It lasted 20 years. Except for, I guess, Zap Comics, it's still the longest lasting comics anthology.
For the undergrounds.
Yeah.
How many issues were there from that time?
Oh, I think we had about 20 issues. We kind of had like one issue a year, you know?
And you were the editor?
No, I edited one issue. No, this was a collective, a women's comics collective. We took turns editing, and in fact, from 1982 to 1992, we doubled up. We had two women working together so that no one could ever be dictator, ever. And I was not ever a dictator. Now, some things again, because some people have said I was, so I thought it might be nice to clear. That's
And who was somebody on the artist?
Well, Lee Mars was, hers is the first name that has to come to mind because she was just outstanding. She had already been, again, she was quite professional. She'd already been assisting above ground syndicated cartoonists, doing background stuff like that. So she really knew her stuff. She was great. But there were others. I mean, Sharon Rudall, who became my roommate, who has since then, she's turned out, last year, she produced a wonderful graphic novel biography of Emma Goldman called Dangerous Woman. She's really good.
It was Joyce Meyer also.
Here's another story. Okay, little did we know, here we were in San Francisco, on the other side of California, in Southern California, at exactly the same time, two women, Joyce Farmer and Lynn Shevely, had decided, again, they were reacting to the male-dominated underground comics, and what they were reacting to specifically was the treatment of women, the sexual treatment of women in these comics, which ranged from simple humiliation of women to torture and murder of women and rape, of course, for men. And they were objecting to that, and they produced their own continued series of comics that they decided would simply deal with sexuality from a woman's viewpoint, and the title was Tits and Clits. Mm-hmm. So we didn't even know about each other. And I will always wonder why it was so serendipitously that at either side of the state of California, women came up with this. Not in New York, not in Chicago, in California. Maybe it was the sunshine.
But it was something. There was also the whole women's liberation.
Oh, that was going on everywhere.
Yes, exactly. And we should mention also that Joyce Farmer has got the most amazing graphic novel coming out this year.
Yes.
Called Special Exit. It's taken us something like 5 years.
Yeah, more than five years.
I've just been starting reading it. It's about her parents' elderly lives and their eventual past.
Their decline and death, yeah.
Which is really amazing work, yeah.
What's it called?
Special Exits. Joyce Farmer's
movie. Yeah, it's great. I've seen some of it. Mm-hmm.
Who was the first woman you were talking about? I missed the first artist you were talking about.
Which? Lee Mars.
Lee Mars, yes. Lee Mars. She did Punch Girl Wimp.
And she's still doing comics. She went on and she did a lot of work in video games and electronic arts and things like that. And she's been doing some comics on the web, too. I'm not sure what the status is of it now, but she got into that. Teaching animation at local community colleges.
She's extraordinary. Were you aware of the Women Artists International? I know you've actually...
Later.
Aware of
Later, I discovered the French women.
Yeah.
You know, were fantastic. Claire Ricochet came to San Francisco and visited me, you know, it was great. And then very briefly, for only six issues, there was this amazing comic in 1977 that came out of France. It was called Anana. And I searched, and later found out that means pineapple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it also, of course, Nana is like the equivalent of chick, it's French slang. And they published women, comics by women from all over the world, including me. I mean, there were some American women, too, me, Sherry Flanagan, I can't remember who else. It was great. It only lasted six issues, but it was a fabulous six issues.
When was this?
77.
Do you have some more questions from Katrina?
Trina, could you speak, we just in the break talked a little about Friends of Lulu. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it starts in Hazard and what's happened now?
Yeah.
And what needs to happen?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I wish we had something like Ladies Do Comics in San Francisco. It feels so good.
French.
It just feels so good to be among you women. It feels wonderful. I wish we had something like that. We almost had something like that. We had an organization called Friends of Lulu that lasted pretty damn long. I can't think of how many years it lasted. It started, I think, in the last century, you know, in the 1990s. So it lasted for a long time.
Is that from Little Lulu?
Yes, yeah. Because Little Lulu was always trying to break into the boys' clubhouse. The boys had a clubhouse that said, no girls allowed. And a continuing theme, yes, a continuing theme in Little Lulu was her attempts to break into that clubhouse. And that's why we were called Friends of Lulu. And it was an organization not just for women doing comics, but also to encourage the participation in general in comics by women, meaning reading them, writing them, whatever. It was pretty good while it lasted, but it just petered out, I'm afraid. I really feel bad about that. The president of the last board of directors, I was briefly on the board of directors back in the late 90s, you know. We even had, you know, at the peak, we did LuluCons. We had conventions. We gave out awards. I have received I've received the Lulu Award, I've been inducted into the Friends of Lulu Hall of Fame. They have like 11 categories. I think I've received a Friends of Lulu Award in at least three of the four categories. And it's really encouraging, you know, to get this award when the guys aren't giving me any awards, when the San Diego Convention isn't giving me any awards, but Friends of Lulu is, that's very encouraging. For any women, not just for me. So at its peak, it was a great organization, but it seems like the energy is gone, and I feel really bad about that. Yeah.
Tell me, did you ever meet anybody like Madge or Tarpey Mills or
I knew Dale Messick. Yes, I knew Dale Messick.
Dale Messick came from her retirement community in Santa Rosa, an hour's drive down to San Francisco, and we all went, you invited other parties,
yeah.
And we all went out.
She took us out for sushi.
Yeah.
She was wonderful, and I also went to, where was it? Was it in Chicago? I can't remember now, but some college in some city had a talk on women in comics. And invited both of us, and we flew out together side by side in the play. She, of course, was, you know, because she really related to her character. She dyed her hair red. Later, when she got much older, she reverted to white, but she dyed her hair red just like Dale, like Brenda Starr. And she dressed to kill. I mean, when we went to this place, it was wintertime, and she was wearing like this wolf coat. I swear to God, silver wolf or something, you know? And rhinestone earrings and everything, and here I was, you know, just, you know, in jeans, and I had a fur coat too, but it was like this vintage, you know, this vintage mouton that was, you know, kind of wearing out in the seams.
Her hats were pretty good too.
Oh, she always wore fabulous hats, and she, at this point in her life, I mean, she was, I think when we went to this together, she was already in her 80s. She had developed a series of one-liners. I mean, because I was with her a lot, I heard her say this to various people, but they were brilliant. You know, like she would say, you know, about someone, you know, does anyone object to you wearing fur? Well, at this stage of my life, I look better in a fur coat than in a bikini.
Very good answer.
Yeah, she had some great lines.
I have a question about the image you showed from, one of the images you showed from Red Star. We looked at where a man says, I love you so.
Yes.
Did that character look like he might have been black or ethnic?
No, absolutely not. She had some, did have some black characters, she did have some ethnic characters, but not for romance with Brendan.
I wonder.
She had a beautiful black woman nightclub entertainer character. Uh-huh. And she had some, you know, like Latin lover types.
Right.
Who might, in fact, the Latin lover types might have made a play for Brendan.
Yeah.
There was one image, I had a look at it during the break, Scenes of Spring, the hats.
Isn't that pretty?
Who's with that one?
That's Ethel Hayes. Excuse me, Ethel Hayes, and she was just the quintessential flapper cartoonist. She kind of followed after Nell Brinkley. You know, Nell Brinkley came first. I mean, Nell Brinkley started in 07. Ethel Hayes came around by the mid-20s, but there was a whole genre in the newspaper strips of that period, which was flapper cartoons. And a lot of women, of course, were drawing them, these really cute flapper comics.
But they were quite sharp. There were quite a few caricatures in the faces.
Oh, she was brilliant.
She the left one.
Oh, no, she was sharp. A brilliant artist. Yeah. Brilliant. Very, think, big John Hill Jr. influence.
Sorry?
If you're familiar, John Hill Jr. was a very famous... Junior, very famous cartoonist of the 20s, who drew very cute little flapper cheeks and chibas, you know, the 1920s cute guys and cute girls, you know, doing the Charleston with long skinny legs and all angles and stuff. And I think he was a big influence on her.
Mm.
Yes.
You spoke earlier about how these early female cartoonists were well reported in the media because they were glamorous characters and sold millions. But in your professional career as a cartoonist, I was wondering how much you've noticed yourself and your female contemporaries being reported in the media.
I get interviewed a lot, some other women, I guess, get interviewed.
Because I imagine coming from San Francisco, the Village Voice, at the very least, would be interested in women comics and the alternate press.
The Village Voice is from New York.
Okay.
I know, it's all the same.
Yeah, yeah.
When in that 1972 or 3, whenever the first women's comic, 72, comic book was published, there was a comics convention in Berkeley, and Lynn M. Joyce came up from Laguna Beach to Berkeley. So there was suddenly this women's comics collective in San Francisco with our first women's comics, and Joyce and Lynn went tits and clips. And that actually had a huge impact. We were like the, you know, everybody was like, whoa, women did this. And we got a lot of write-ups in the major papers there. A stir that was great and long overdue, although ironically, I think the first issues of both of those magazines were not nearly as good graphically as they became.
Oh, we got much better, oh my God.
But the fact that women were doing them, people really, it really made them sit up and take notice.
I was just wondering, do you think 4 decades on that there is still a need for women's owning comics type like you produced then? If so, for example, you're talking about tits and clits, so the problem for women then was sexual revolution. Well, our generation has, it's not an issue. So I just wonder if you think there is a space, a need for that kind of women only, what issues would it deal with?
Well, you tell me, I don't know much about the British comics industry, but in the British comics industry, is there like a mainstream, you know, where you really get paid good money for comics?
Well,
in that main trickle, how many women
Very well, I think there's no, as I know, there's maybe that one woman artist draws for the Beano Danny, that's Laura. Any more?
Okay, well, that answers the exception. Well, that
is,
and then he talks in the break also about graphic novels.
Yeah, graphic novels where there is.
Perhaps graphic novels, yes, where women can have.
Graphic novels has saved women. Graphic novels saved me. I mean, there was no place for me to be published. Nobody wanted my work. They'd say, oh, this is very nice, but it's for girls. You know, girls don't read comics, which I knew, of course, was not true. That's why I do all my books. Now that there are graphic novels, I'm writing them. I write a lot of graphic novels, and they're for young readers, and I'm delighted, because I want to do stuff for young readers.
Why are they for young readers? Just
why not for young readers? What is there for young readers? What is there out there? What has been out there for young readers? I don't know about England, but in America, not much.
No. That's exactly why Children of Man has been able to come
I wanted to ask you the same thing, because I think that, and probably especially since that, you know, you describing, you know, women who were artists working for newspapers and so on before the war, and then there was this shift after the war. And certainly kind of right throughout that time have always been, there's certainly in the UK, there's a very, very strong sort of history of, you know, female artists who are book illustrators and so on. There always has been, and that continues. And now for the first time, it's like great, because a lot of the people who are doing illustration courses are really very much, a lot of their work is very sort of comic strippy, and the, you know, the barriers going down all the time, but it's really that incredibly rich tradition is now sort of breaking up. I think it's very exciting to see that. And also, obviously, kind of people who are fine artists are looking to the kind of the graphic novel form for some of their work.
Yes.
Do you feel that, I mean, that's how I sort of think things are here. Do you feel that's the same in the States?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is where women are being published. You know, yeah, I mentioned all these women who have been published by the small presses or self-published, but that's not any money at all, you know. But graphic novels, real publishers who will really pay you, you know. This is wonderful, and this is where women are doing graphic novels, and where they're breaking through to the mainstream is with graphic novels.
Yeah, Alison Bechtel's an example.
Alison Bechtel and Marjane Satrapi.
Nicola's question is interesting, because it is a question of, obviously there was a very strong reason for doing it in eBay comics and women's comics in 72 and onwards. And what we have in the UK, you might be aware, there's a very good project called Horse of Mensa. And I'm telling you, Mensa aren't very happy about the title. And then Ellen Linda's coming in next week to launch them their fifth birthday issue, and it's a tremendous anthology with UK women artists. But I suppose my question is really, what issues still concern women that need to be addressed? In the same way that you and Joyce and Joyce Bisbeth were addressing in the 70s, what needs to be addressed now?
Does something have
to... Do you? Obviously, the data always has to be addressed. It's grown for all kinds of comics.
I mean, can't you just tell a story?
Oh, sure.
All I want to do, I want to tell good stories for young readers that are not people punching each other out. I want to tell my stories, and I know my stories are good. You know, I want to tell a story that isn't a superhero story. You know, and why not? What's wrong with that? Why do we have to have a cause? You know,
on that note, then I could say to you, well, why does it have to be women only?
The women only is because there are so many places where women can't publish, and women who aren't writing or drawing graphic novels yet, women who would just like to do a nice 4-page comic, and they're good, and they have something to say, and there's nowhere else for them to be published. You know, that's why I'm going to mention about Marvel's girl comics. I mean, all these guys who are objecting, and all these women who contributors were saying, well, when was the last time I worked for Marvel? You know, 5 years ago, I'm finally getting to do another story for Marvel.
Do you think that with the current popularity of graphic novels and various publishers looking for the next big thing, that gender is no longer a problem? Because I've spoken, for example, to various female creators, Hannah Berry springs to mind, for example, who did this graphic novel called Britain and Drew Lightly. Mm-hmm. And she was pretty much headhunted by Jonathan Cape because she showed some pages from her graphic novel in her final degree show.
A lot of the publishers are looking for women, and that's why I'm so happy, because they come to me too, you know, among the women, because they know that we do good stuff. And they also, because finally, okay, librarians and teachers love me, because, you know, they have all these comics, and it's all boy stuff, and they want stuff out there for girls. The teachers want stuff for girls. The librarians want stuff for girls. They want it. They want it. And so, yeah, it's sex is still an issue, you know, because there still isn't, it's nice, there's more and more stuff out there for girls, but there still isn't, it's still not even, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I was kind of getting at is if you've got publishers going to art degree shows looking for the next big thing, gender's no longer an issue because they just look at the art on the wall and then they might try and find out who the artist is and who did it.
Yes, you're right, with mainstream book publishers who are now doing graphic novels, yes. And that's why I say graphic novels are saving the women cartoonists. Yeah, definitely.
But I think I read an interview with Jessica Abel once, who said almost that she got annoyed that people always asked her about her gender, about being a woman artist. And I'm not sure what I thought about that, because I thought, well, she has done so well, and she does do great
work.
But at the same time, she's our ambassador. She is an ambassador. It just seems a bit disingenuous to say, oh, I'm not interested in that. Well, I get annoyed that people ask me, because in a sense, she should say, well, something, I don't know.
Jessica is also the one who, when interviewed for that article on We Are Women, said, oh, well, there were women in the past, but they weren't.
Exactly, that's my point.
Not every woman is a feminist.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you know that.
Yes.
You know, you can be a really smart woman and a really talented woman and still not be a feminist.
Oh, yeah, and Margaret Thatcher was.
There you go.
We've raised the F word, and Peter and I just got back from the Comics Festival in Helsinki, where one of the panels was about exporting comics from Scandinavia, from Finland, wherever, how exporting comics works. And one of the people on the panel was a guy, but he's called Johannes. He edits a magazine in Sweden called Galago, or whatever you pronounce it. And in Sweden, they've had third wave feminism as a major cultural social force. I was actually there earlier in April at the Stockholm Comics Festival, and I took part in, I actually shared a panel, I was pretty terrified, at a feminist political party conference, and with women artists, of course, all of whom were addressing very strong issues still, because there's still, you know, inequalities, plenty of prejudices and sexism abundant in our society. And when this chap Johannes was explaining, he says that they are selling more and more of their magazine to women. It's actually, in fact, their magazine is 50-50 in terms of contributors. Their cover is always alternating between men and women artists. They have, and these books they're publishing, are selling 5,000-10,000 copies like that. They're actually incredibly successful. There's a real appetite among women, young women, and often very feminine, criticized women for these kinds of comics, and they are. Absolutely, they are the modern continuation, if you like, of what you did with women's comics. It's still happening. This is like the next wave, which I don't think we've even
yet. Wave.
We haven't even seen it yet in the UK or America.
I'm sure you have. Third wave feminist.
Yeah.
It's a very common term there.
Yeah, but whether it's coming through in comics, I don't know if it's coming through.
Oh,
maybe,
I see.
Maybe more so than that. I don't know. Maybe this is part of that, actually. Ladies is part of that.
And also, just to
it is. Ladies do comics. It's third
wave. And last year, we had a Women in Comics conference.
Yeah.
Last year.
The first in the country.
And then we're doing a
this
year. We're also, I mean, it's this whole idea about the women being in the production as well, because if we create women academics, people interested in charting, writing, managing research in women's comics, the current women who are working, then we are also controlling creating our own history.
Yes.
And that's so, I think we should also think about, we should be the ones writing about ourselves.
Of course.
And being our own publishing machine. And that's the question I asked before, is what could women do more? And I think that's probably something we should think, take a responsibility to create our own literature, create our own culture that way, and not wait for
those established comics.
Absolutely.
Men trained.
And you are doing that. That's what Ladies Do Comics. You guys did it. You said, yes, you know, you took responsibility and you put this together. Yes.
And I think, as I say, Ladies Do Creators, and also as academics, researchers,
yes,
a responsibility to write the history.
I belong to an email list, Paul belongs to it too, called Comics Scholars. It's academics who write about comics. But some of the women, you know, have gotten, or have gotten in the past, a little annoyed about long, long scholarly discussions about superhero comics. And we formed our own group called Women Comics Scholars.
Really?
Yeah.
Could you send us that link?
And then
yeah,
anyone could know about it. It's not a website, it's just a little email list.
If you could introduce everyone. The one thing that Trina's done, and I know she's very generous with her time, I've introduced her to someone on the stream who asked her to help and to give her some help with her own research, and you introduced me for the exhibition we're doing, which is Sharon, you introduced me to Susie Barty, mm-hmm. who'll be talking about women in comics, and I think that's a really important role that you have is introducing and enabling this forum.
I would like to make a statement, and that is the only people who can help us is ourselves. So do that. Pass on the information. Introduce people. I mean, I, in my career, have encountered far too many women in positions of power in mainstream comics who would not do that because they didn't want to be tarred with the word F, you know, or because they were afraid that if they helped another woman, they might lose their position that they had attained. And this is very sad. So it's something that we all need to remember is help other women, you know. And I don't mean, well, you know, she's 15 years old and she's a terrible artist, but she might have some promise, but publish her in your anthology. No, she's not ready yet, you know, but encourage her, you know.
I think that's a really wonderful way to talk about all these projects that we do, and a very wonderful, I don't know if we've really finished, but one of the final thoughts I'd love everyone to leave this space with. I think that's really empowering for everything. Really.
Bravo.
So, thank you so much.
If you'd like to know more about Ladies Do Comics, which I direct with Nicola Streeton, and which is open to men and women, see our website, www.ladiesdocomics.com. Our next meeting is 28th of February at the Rag Factory, Brick Lane. Hope to see you there.